Our next speaker, Ms. Mary Pervet, was interned in, as you see, the Japanese concentration camp for 3 years.
There was going to be a war, but it wasn't going to be America's war, we thought. I was a child in China, the daughter of American missionaries, and the Japanese had been nibbling all across the Far East and had come to the section of China, the Hunan, in the Yellow River Basin where my parents were. And there was a rule the Japanese had, that if a Japanese soldier passed by, you got off your bicycle and bowed. And there were a few times my mother had not bowed fast enough when she got off her bicycle and she had been struck over the head with a stick. So my parents decided to take a break from their missionary education work in the center of China and went to the coast where my older brother and sister were already in the school for missionaries' children. You have to understand, if you're a missionary's kid, that there are only two or three places you can go to school to learn English in a continent like China. On the coast of China, the Japanese had already arrived with their gunboats in the harbor, and I can remember we would cower under the beds at night as the rockets would hurl over the hills into the mountains behind the ocean. And we could see the bloodied soldiers the next morning, the Chinese soldiers coming out from their guerrilla hideouts in the caves and go limping with their bloody bandages along the road behind our house. It was our practice to crawl under the beds and pray that God would take care of us. It was someone else's war because none of us believed that America would ever be involved. But my mother knew we'd be faced with separations, and she said, how do you pour God's promises into the hearts of little children? There were four Taylor children, Kathleen, Jamie, Mary, and Johnny. And my mother was Pennsylvania Dutch from around Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And she said, you make kids learn God's promises by heart. So she said, I will put God's promises to music. And she took Psalm 91, and in a family ritual, every morning after breakfast, the little Taylor choir would gather around the old-fashioned pump organ. Remember that, where you had to pump your feet to make the music come out? And Mother would make us sing by heart the beautiful words of Psalm 91. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. And then on those incredible words, 1,000 shall fall at thy side, 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. And the little Taylor choir would sing, he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee. My parents left us at the school for missionaries' children on the coast of China, returning to the interior to continue their missionary work. We awakened on December 8, 1941, to find Japanese soldiers on the steps of our school with bayonets, guard dogs, and suddenly a whole school full of missionaries' children were now prisoners of the Japanese. At first we were just held wearing armbands with an A if we were American, B for British, but it wasn't too long till the soldiers said that this beautiful compound that had been dedicated to God's children was now going to become a military base on the coast of China for the Japanese Navy. I remember the day they marched us into concentration camp. Up at the front of the line, a snaking line of children and missionary teachers, our headmaster began to sing from the Psalms, God is our refuge and strength, therefore we will not fear. We were marched into concentration camp and eventually arrived at the Weishien concentration camp. The Japanese called it the Weishien Civilian Assembly Center, with 1,400 prisoners. I should tell you that we did not see our parents for 5.5 years, and that is a story I can't tell you today. The story of what kept our hearts and the hearts of our parents, now separated as we were by warring armies between us with no way to get together. And that's a whole story of miracles all of its own. I'm not going to go into a lot of details about the war camp experience, because you have lived it more than I have. You know about the bed bugs. You know about eating out of tin cans. You know about figuring how to sleep on something midst of a bloody war. Our teachers, who became prisoners and marched into the camp with us, made that a paramount issue. They said to us, you may be a prisoner on the outside, but you're not a prisoner on the inside. You will go to school, even if it's sitting on the floor, even if it's writing on a little slate, even if it's pretending you're in a classroom when you're not, because you're not a prisoner on the inside. They would make us line up every day, our teachers, mind you, not the Japanese guards in the barracks. Have a daily inspection. Were you clean? Were you neat? Did you have your mending done? Had you patched the holes in your clothes? Because what was happening in the spirit would help you to survive. The Salvation Army Band had been marched into the camp, prisoners of war too. And they said, we will win this war, and we don't know who's going to win, but we will be ready for whoever it is. And every night, 1,400 prisoners in this camp, the Salvation Army Band practiced outside the Japanese commandant's office. And they said, we'll make a victory medley mixed together. Happy days are here again, and mixed together with the national anthems of America, England, Russia, and China. Because they said, we don't know who's going to rescue us, but we'll be ready for whichever one it is. And there they practiced the victory medley for when that day would come. The grown-ups in the camp said it was a big deal for kids to play. Keep up the spirit. Oh, a lot of people said, no, no. In other concentration camps in China, they said, you don't have calories enough to waste on play. You won't have fun and games. But our teachers and folks said, yes, you will, because keeping the spirit up is what keeps people alive in a concentration camp. And people organized games and competitions. They organized a ball field, tiny though it was, probably not even as big as this room. And on summer evenings, we had a league of ball teams playing. The Priest's Padres, the Peking Panthers, the Tianjin Tigers playing out on the ball field at night, and puny, scrawny prisoners screaming and shouting for the team to win. One of the prisoners who was in our camp was Eric Little, and many of you have seen the movie Chariots of Fire. The Olympic athlete that refused to run on Sunday because of his religious beliefs. Eric Little was a prisoner in the camp and took as his mission to keep up the spirits of the children, like the little Taylor children in that place. Uncle Eric died in that camp, Eric Little, the Olympic athlete that became world news in the 1924 Olympics, and we children were the honor guard when he died, carrying him to the little funeral plot where dead prisoners were buried. We began hearing rumors that the war was coming to a close, but we didn't know. I can remember in August of 1945, we had been in the camp for 3 years now, and by this time we had not seen our parents for 5.5 years. Lying on the steamer trunks. All the other kids were out playing. I was laid low by dysentery. And as I'm lying in the desperate heat, I heard an airplane, and I knew it could not be an airplane. And as I listened, it came closer and closer, and I jumped off the steamer trunks to look out the window of the barracks, and I could see a B-24 bomber coming low over the gates of the, over the treetops of the camp, so low you could even see into the light, up into the windows of the plane. As I watched, so low the plane was, the belly of the plane opened and out dropped these giant poppies dropping into the fields beyond the camp. It was like instant cure for diarrhea. I jumped up from the steamer trunks where I had been pining and figured I would be the first of 1,400 prisoners to get to the gate. People were screaming and shouting, hammering the skies, hammering the dirt ground with their fists, weeping, dancing, shouting, and burst into the fields. I was probably the 1,400 prisoner to get to the gate, surging out into the fields to rescue those American airmen who had dropped like gods from the sky, and they were gods. They were gorgeous. They were fat. You could pinch the meat. The puny prisoners hoisted these American gods up onto their bony platform of shoulders. Six American airmen and a Chinese interpreter with them, hoisting them toward the concentration camp gate. Salvation Army Band was playing a victory medley. And when they got to that part, oh, say, does that star-spangled banner still wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? The young American major slipped down from that bony platform of shoulders where the prisoners had been carrying him to a standing salute. And a young American trombonist in the Salvation Army Band crumpled to the ground and wept. We were free after 3 years in this place. The Americans took over the camp, and we were liberated not long after that. And when I tell the story, I usually stop right there. Reunited with our parents after 5.5 years, until last year. Last year, when I was running for political office as a candidate for the New Jersey Assembly, I told this story to a political meeting, and I said, I have much to give back to this land for 53 years of freedom. And I said, I could never pay that back. 6 young Americans rescued me, risking their lives. I was invited a few days after saying that to stand in for Senator John Adler to read a proclamation at a veterans reunion of a group called the China Burma India Veterans Association, and some of you here may belong to that group. Senator Adler said, Mary, I wonder if you'll stand in for me and read this proclamation to this group. And I said, I can't believe this. You know I want to do that. That's who rescued us, people from the China Burma India Theater of Operations. So I went to a meeting in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, about 150 men and women like yourselves, having a national East Coast reunion of the China Burma India Veterans Association. And I read the proclamation, but a little trigger went on in my head earlier in the day and said, Mary, get the list of names of those heroes that rescued you before you go tonight to this banquet. So I printed out the names of the American airmen and took them with me to the banquet. And after I read the ceremonial proclamation to the group, I said, I know this was not an accident that I was invited to speak to you this evening and substitute for Senator Adler to read this proclamation. And I briefly told them the story of our rescue. And I said, I just wonder, is anyone in the room of those who rescued me? And I said, let me read their names and ranks. And I read off the names and all the details. And there was silence except for people weeping. And after the ceremony, people came to me. One man gave me a piece of parachute that had saved his life as he was paratrooping down into Burma when his plane had run out of fuel. And they said, nobody was there, but we have a national magazine, they said, and you can put an article about your search in the national magazine and list their names and tell us where they can contact you. One of the men became so beside himself with interest, a man from Maryland, said, I'm taking this list. And he started an internet search of every name in the United States that matched my 6 American heroes. I went on about my political campaign, and I did indeed write an article in their national journal called Sound Off, saying I was looking for these American heroes that had rescued the Weixian concentration camp. In September, I got a phone call from a woman who lives 10 minutes from my house. She said, I have read this article in Sound Off that you are looking for these 6 heroes. She said, my sister lives next door to one of them in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania. Here is the phone number. And on a September night, I telephoned the number of Raymond Hanschelak, Little Bear Creek, Pennsylvania. And a lady answered, and I said, I'm calling for Raymond Hanschelak. connect with you. We talked and talked and talked, Helen Hanchelak and I. She said he was in the Office of Strategic Services, CIA these days. She said he never talked, and it was like I was telling her a chapter out of her husband's life that she had never known. The gentleman from Maryland had now sent me a stack of lists of names and addresses of every name in the United States that matched my list of heroes. And now I started to pick up those pages and begin to make telephone calls. There was only one Peter Orlick in all of the United States on my list of names, so I called Peter Orlick in Queens, New York. And a lady answered the phone. And I said, I'm calling for Peter Orlick. And she said, and who's calling? And I explained, I said, you wouldn't really know me. When I told her what it was, she said, oh, no. She said, my Pete died 4 years ago. By now I was completely driven because I was fearful that I would find only widows. I started on that list of names. The next one was Tad Nagaki from Alliance, Nebraska. And on a Sunday night when the telephone rates were a little cheaper, I started to call Alliance, Nebraska. And a gentleman answered and I said, sir, I'm calling for Tad Nagaki. And he said, speaking, I had made my first connect of a hero that had rescued me 53 years ago. I cannot tell you what it feels like to say thank you for 53 years of freedom. Tad Nagaki and I started chattering over the phone. I said, Mr. Nagaki, he says, call me Tad. I said, what did it feel like for us to trail you wherever you went? We wanted your buttons. He says, yeah, you wanted my hair. You wanted my insignia. You wanted everything. I says, I remember we trailed you to the toilets. We trailed you everywhere like you were gods. We wanted to never let you out of our sight. And he said, it made us feel like we were on a pedestal. I said, Tad, that is the understatement of the century. Tad Nagaki said he could give me the telephone number of Jimmy Moore. Jimmy Moore in Dallas, Texas. It's a good thing Tad Nagaki gave me Jimmy Moore's telephone number. They had kept in touch, as you, many of you do, through the years. Because I had a list of 150 Jimmy Moores to call to try to find this man, so I was grateful. With one phone call, I connected with Jimmy Moore. I will never, if I am a writer, I am an author, never in my wildest, vivid imagination could I have invented the story that Jimmy Moore told me. But I reached him in Dallas, Texas. He said, Mary, I attended the same school for missionaries' children that you did in China. I was a missionary service in America to do, and I didn't have to go to war. But he said, our chief of school for missionaries' children, Alumni Magazine, said, the school has been captured, marched off to prison camp by the Japanese. My teachers that were my good teachers in school, 10, so many years ago. And the little brothers and sisters of my classmates marched as prisoners of war into camp. He said, I resigned from the FBI, joined the military, went to China, and signed up for that rescue mission. The first person I asked to when the prisoners hoisted us into that camp was the headmaster principal of the chief of school. That was Jimmy Moore. Now I had no more names. I had found four. Two widows and two live heroes. Jimmy Moore knew how much I wanted to find everybody. I had run out of names. I found out why I had run out of names a little later, because Mrs. Orlick, Pete Orlick, the widow in Queens, New York, had sent me a beautiful embroidered strip of parachute, embroidered with the rescue scene. And each of the men had signed their name next to their parachute dropping from the skies. And I realized why I was running a dead end on some of the men. Because the signatures of the men on the parachute slip was spelled differently than the names that I had used in the rescue from the American Rescue Mission report. One day I was at work and the phone rang and it was Jimmy Moore from Dallas, Texas. He says, Mary, I've got good news for you. I found Major Steiger. And sure enough, in Reno, Nevada, now almost 80 years old, Major Stanley Steiger, very puny, recently broken his hip, unable to walk, and I connected with him in the middle of the day at high telephone rates time, and was able to say thank you to the hero of the mission that had rescued us 53 years before. It was another about 2 or 3 weeks, and Jimmy Moore called me from Texas again. He said, Mary, one of my good buddies next door looked up this last name on a list of internet names and addresses of every driver's license in the United States. And he says, I found Jim Hammond in Yucca Valley, California. Well, this time I waited until I got home and the rates were a little low. And after 6 o'clock at night, I got Jim Hammond, the last of the six heroes that rescued me. I honor you today as I honor these extraordinary men who, when I talk to them, when I call them on the phone and say they are heroes, they say, it was no big deal. Any American would have done it. And I say to them, it was a big deal to 1,400 prisoners whose lives you gave back to us. So I honor you today with my remarks and my thanks. It has been my greatest joy, above and beyond being elected to political office, this year to be able to call newspapers all across America and say to them, you have a hero in your neighborhood, and here's what his name is. And in most of those cities, these wonderful men who rescued us 53 years ago have been spotlighted on the front pages of their newspapers. 53 years late, I would say. But America says thank you to them, and I say thank you to you.